Have you ever gotten so lost in a book or a movie that the world around you just melts away? Or found yourself tearing up for a character, logically isn't even real?
Oh, constantly. It's that feeling of being completely transported. You're not just observing a story for a moment, you're actually living inside of it.
Exactly. And as a screenwriter, that's the alchemy I'm always chasing. For the longest time, I just thought of it as an art, kind of magic. But the question that's always gnawed at me is, why? Why does it work? Why do our brains crave stories so much?
And that's where my fascination kicks in, but from a slightly different angle. I'm captivated by how we construct our own identity. We don't just remember facts about our lives, we weave them into a personal narrative, a life story.
Right, the story of us.
And the idea that the very same piece of neural hardware that helps us follow the plot of a thriller is also responsible for offering our own sense of self. That's just mind-bending to me. It connects the fiction we consume with the reality we create for
It
ourselves.
really does. It suggests that storytelling isn't just entertainment, it's a fundamental biological process. And today, that's what we're here to explore. We're pulling back the curtain on the neuroscience behind our inherent love for narrative. We're going to be talking about the brain's own silent storyteller, the temporal lobe.
We'll be delving into how this incredible part of the brain processes language, memory, and emotion, not as separate things, but as the ingredients it uses to help us comprehend complex narratives and connect with characters on a deeply human level.
Okay, so let's grab onto that thread, the ingredients, language, memory, and emotion. As a storyteller, the one that I feel is the most volatile, the most powerful, is emotion. You can have the most beautiful language, the most intricate plot, but if the audience doesn't feel anything, it's just noise, isn't it?
It's just data. From a neurological standpoint, that's precisely what's happening. The temporal lobe doesn't work in isolation. It's deeply interconnected with the limbic system, especially the amygdala, which is basically the brain's emotional alarm bell and significance tagger.
Significance tagger. I love that. So, a scene in a movie isn't just being processed as visual and auditory information. The amygdala is basically asking, does this matter? Should I care?
Constantly. A flat, emotionless story provides no tags. The brain sees it, understands the words via Wernicke's area in the temporal lobe, but it doesn't get flagged as something to invest in. But show a character's face filled with fear, the amygdala lights up. It says, pay attention. This is important for survival, even if it's fictional survival.
Wow. So that's why a jump scare works, but it's also why a scene of quiet heartbreak can be so devastating. The brain is recognizing a fundamental human emotional state and flagging it as salient.
Exactly. And that leads right into the second ingredient, memory. The temporal lobe contains the hippocampus, the master architect of our memories. When you feel that heartbreak for a character, why does it feel so real, so personal?
I've always assumed it was just empathy, a kind of abstract understanding.
It's more than that. It's neural resonance. Your hippocampus is actively searching your own lived experiences, your own memories of loss or sadness, and creating a bridge to the character. It's not abstract at all. Your brain is running a low-level simulation of that feeling, using your own past as the source code.
That is unsettling and also incredible. So when I write a scene where a father says goodbye to his daughter, I'm not just writing dialogue. I'm creating a prompt that asks the audience's brain to access its own files on goodbye, family, loss.
You're providing the key, and their hippocampus is finding the lock it fits. That's why the same scene can make one person tear up thinking of a specific memory, while another person might feel a more general sense of melancholy. The prompt is the same, but the personal databases are unique.
So my control as the author is armor. Well, it's kind of an illusion then, isn't it? I think I'm crafting this one perfect singular emotional experience, but what's actually happening is I'm sending out a prompt and a million different brains are running a million different programs in response.
It's less an illusion and more of a partnership. You're not losing control. You're inviting co-creation. Think of it this way. A great chef can't control the individual taste buds or scent memories of every diner, but they can create a dish with such a masterful balance of flavors that it guides the experience towards a specific, intended feeling. You're doing the same thing with narrative ingredients.
A partnership. I like that. It feels more collaborative. But what happens when someone's database is empty for that particular prompt? What if I write about a profound sense of brotherly love, and someone in the audience is an only child who never had that bond? Is the story just a dead letter to them?
Ah, that is a fantastic question. And the answer is no, because the brain is an incredible gap filler. If it can't find a direct memory in the hippocampus, it starts to build a composite. It pulls from stories it's heard, from other films it's seen, from observing friends. It creates a sort of an emotional mosaic. The connection might be less direct, less visceral, but the brain still constructs an approximation of that feeling.
So it's the difference between reliving an emotion and and imagining one for the first time based on secondhand data.
Precisely. But there's another layer here that goes beyond just emotional memory. It's about physical experience. There's a fascinating phenomenon called neural coupling.
Okay. You can't just drop a term like neural coupling and not explain it.
Huh. Fair enough. In simple terms, when you listen to a well-told story, your brain activity starts to synchronize with the storyteller's brain. But it gets even weirder. If I describe running through a forest, the motor cortex in your brain, the part that would control your legs if you were running, shows a little flicker of activity.
Get out of here. Seriously?
It's true. The story isn't just an abstract concept your language centers are decoding. Your brain is running a full-body simulation. When a character grasps a cup of coffee, your sensory cortex fires in the area that corresponds to your own hand. You don't just understand the story. On a very real neurological level, you are embodying it.
So, wait, let me get this straight. When I write, he ran his thumb over the chipped rim of the mug, it's not just an image. Somewhere in the reader's brain, the little cluster of neurons responsible for their own thumb is having a moment?
It's having a little ghost moment, yes. It's a faint signal, but it's there. It's the foundation of what scientists call mirror neurons.
Mm-hmm. Mirror neurons, I've heard that term, but I always thought it was more about, you know, seeing a monkey grab a banana and having the same part of your brain light up. I never applied it to it. Julie, to words on a page.
But language is just a set of symbols that triggers concepts and memories, right? And those concepts are tied to physical experiences. So the words chipped rim trigger the sensory memory of that texture, and ran his thumb triggers the motor simulation of the action. You're basically using language to remote control a simulation inside someone else's head.
That is profoundly strange. And it gives a whole new weight to the old writing advice, show, don't tell. We always said it's because it's more engaging, more vivid, but this is the why. Telling someone a character is nervous is an abstract fact.
It's data to be decoded.
Right. But describing them tapping their fingers on a tabletop, their leg bouncing, that's a series of physical instructions for the reader's brain to simulate. You're making them feel the physical jitters of nervousness, not just understand the label for it.
You're inviting their motor cortex to the party, and that physical embodiment makes the emotional connection exponentially stronger. It's why a well-choreographed fight scene can leave you feeling breathless, or a scene where a character is freezing can make you feel a phantom chill. Your body is playing along.
Okay, but fool. Does that have a limit? Because I've written characters who do things I could never do. I write about astronauts. About surgeons. My brain doesn't have a direct experience file for performing open-heart surgery. So what happens then? Does the simulation just sail? Oh, that's a brilliant point. No, it doesn't fail. It does what it did with the emotional mosaic we talked about earlier. It builds a composite.
It pulls from every movie you've seen about surgeons, every documentary. It simulates the component parts it does know, the feeling of intense focus, the delicate movements of the hands, the tension in the shoulders. It builds an approximation of the experience.
So the more sensory details I provide, the more raw material I'm giving the reader's brain to build a more accurate, more vivid simulation. The color of the gloves, the beep of the monitor, the coldness of the steel instrument.
You're giving it more and more high-resolution data points to construct its virtual reality, and this is where it gets really interesting from an identity perspective. We're not just simulating actions, we're simulating intentions.
What do you mean? How can you simulate an intention?
Well, mirror neurons don't just fire for the action itself, but for the goal of the action. If I see you reaching for a glass, my brain simulates reaching for a glass. But if the context shows you're thirsty, it simulates reaching to drink. If the context shows you're angry, it simulates reaching to throw. We're constantly running these low-level predictions about not just what people are doing, but why they're doing it.
And that's the corentor, that's the core of character, isn't it? Motivation. Why they do what they do. So when an audience connects with a character, they're not just empathizing with their feelings, they are neurologically simulating and understanding their deepest intentions.
On a fundamental level, yes, you're aligning your brain's goal prediction system with the characters. For a moment, their motivations become your brain's simulated motivations. And that is an incredibly profound and intimate connection.
And it reframes everything for me. The whole act of writing, I thought I was building a fictional world, but what we're really talking about is building a temporary shared consciousness with an audience. It's almost a sacred act when you think of it that way.
It is. And that's the beautiful arc of it, isn't it? We went from the amygdala tagging a scene as emotionally important, to the hippocampus pulling up a personal memory to match it, to the motor cortex literally making you feel the character's physical state.
Mm.
And it all culminates in this, simulating their deepest why, their reason for being.
It makes me look back on every script I've ever written and see it in a completely new light. The moments that really worked, that people still talk to me about.
Yeah.
They weren't the cleverest plot twists. They were the moments of pure, unvarnished, relatable intention. A character wanting to protect their child or wanting to be seen or just wanting a moment of peace.
Because that's where the deepest alignment happens. The audience's brain latches onto that goal and says, ah, I know that feeling. I've wanted that. I am, for this moment, you.
Which leads to a kind of, a lingering question for me in all this. If stories are this powerful, this capable of literally getting inside our heads and running simulations on our neural hardware, what is our responsibility as the people who create them?
Oh, that's the big question. It's immense. Because this entire mechanism, this beautiful system for creating empathy and understanding, it can be hijacked. If you can make someone neurologically simulate the intentions and emotions of a character, you can make them identify with almost anyone, a hero, but also a villain, or a political ideology.
Mm.
You're not just telling a story. You're providing a trial version of a worldview. You're letting someone test drive a way of thinking and feeling, and that can be used to build bridges or it can be used to build walls.
And this is where my final thoughts diverge a little from the pure craft of it all. I keep coming back to our own identity. If we spend our lives simulating other people's intentions, how much of our own life story is an original script? And how much is a collection of scenes we've borrowed from the thousands of stories we've consumed?
Wow. Yeah. Am I making this decision because it's true to me or because I'm simulating a character I admire from a film I saw when I was 15? That's a deeply unsettling thought.
Hmm.
I don't see it as unsettling necessarily. I think it's just human stories give us the templates. They give us the emotional and motivational frameworks to understand our own messy, unscripted lives. They're not a replacement for our identity, but they are very much the scaffolding we use to build it.
Mm-hmm. The scaffolding. I like that. So we've come full circle. From the magic of getting lost in a story to the intricate neural mechanics of the temporal lobe, and finally to seeing stories as the very blueprint for how we understand ourselves and each other.
It's more profound than I even imagined when we started.
It really is. It's not just entertainment. It's a fundamental part of the human operating system. Well, that feels like a fitting place to leave it for today. Thank you, everyone, for lending us your mirror neurons for the past hour.